This is Morning Edition from NPR News. With Steve Inskeep, I'm Renee Montaigne. In the next hour, President Bush is expected to announce his choice to succeed retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The announcement comes on the day the U.S. Supreme Court opens a new term with, for the first time in nearly two decades, a new justice in the center seat. John Roberts, the 17th Chief Justice of the United States, is presiding over a court in transition, dealing with tumultuous cases. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Sitting next to Roberts on the bench today will be Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who announced in July that she would retire upon confirmation of her successor. Little did she know then that Chief Justice William Rehnquist would die within months and that her seat would be unfilled at the start of the term. So O'Connor has hired back one of her clerks from last term and now has a full complement of four. She's at work at least until late November and probably December. That's the best estimate on Capitol Hill for when a successor is likely to be confirmed, even without a bloody confirmation battle. And it means that O'Connor is likely to hear arguments in more than 30 cases and to vote in those cases. Once she retires, though, her previously cast votes don't count in cases not yet announced by the court. So how will the court handle that? As Georgetown law professor Viet Dinh puts it,
obviously, we are in a little bit of a litigation pickle.
In fact, though, this is not a new problem. In 1988, for example, Justice Anthony Kennedy did not arrive at the court until late February. The court had operated for 6 months with eight justices, and in most instances, when they were equally divided, the justices simply listed the cases for re-argument before a full court later so that Kennedy could cast the deciding vote. Similarly, when Justice Harry Blackmun arrived in 1970, the court had been operating for a full year with only eight justices, and there were 17 deadlocked cases from the previous term that were re-argued for the second and some for the third time. Right now, the court has nine justices, and the assumption is that in cases where O'Connor is the deciding vote, the court will hold the case and order it re-argued. In cases where her vote is not decisive, however, and most would fall into that category, the court can proceed as it normally does. If O'Connor is still there when the decision is released, her vote will be included. If she's not, her vote will not be included, and the case will be decided by a majority of eight. As to the assignment of written opinions, O'Connor is a famously fast writer, so the assumption is that she will be assigned to write decisions in a couple of early cases that can be disposed of quickly. She will leave the bench, as she said in her retirement letter, upon the confirmation of a successor. Coupled with a new chief, that will leave the court a very different place. Ted Olson served as the government's advocate in the Supreme Court during the first term of the Bush administration.
These two appointments, when they're completed, will replace 57 years of experience and tenure on the Supreme Court of the United States. And people say that every new appointment to the Supreme Court changes the dynamics of the court completely.
Indeed, the justices themselves say that. Among other things, the justice who ends up at the ideological center will no longer be O'Connor. Georgetown law professor Viet Dinh.
Whenever you ship out a person, the median voter changes on the court, and how that median voter sees his or her new role is anybody's guess.
ACLU chief counsel Stephen Shapiro thinks that median justice will be Anthony Kennedy.
One of the most interesting things, I think, to watch this year will be not the new justices, but Justice Kennedy, and to see the degree to which this justice, who seems very much to be evolving, continues to evolve and becomes the new middle of the court.
Much of the focus in the immediate future, though, will be on the new Chief Justice, John Roberts. On Friday, the newly sworn chief arrived at the court to begin work. He's hired all six members of the late Chief Justice's staff and brought two law clerks and a secretary of his own from the appeals court. He will need all the extra help as he tries to fill the void left by the forceful Chief Justice Rehnquist, who reigned for 19 years, much admired by his colleagues. As Georgetown law professor Richard Lazarus put it,
he ran that place. They had a lot of respect for him. This is a completely different dynamic that a Chief Justice Roberts will be walking into.
Lazarus, who's been Roberts' close friend for 25 years, notes that if Roberts had been confirmed as an associate justice, he would have had time to quietly adjust to his new role. But as chief, there is no place to hide. Yes, the chief justice is only one of nine votes, but he has many duties as head of the third branch of government and even within the court. Just for starters, he presides at the court's weekly conferences, where the justices meet with no one else present. He summarizes the issues in each case before the other justices speak and vote. He assigns who will write decisions when he's in the majority, and he's responsible for making up the initial list of which cases, among the hundreds that come in each week, is to be discussed as a possible case for hearing. When he sits on the court today and in the conference at the end of this week, he will, at age 50, be the youngest justice, and everyone else there will have been there already for one, two, or three decades, Professor Lazarus.
Some of them a very long time. Many of them wanted to be chief justice under one president or another, and they may have tremendous respect for him a lot, but boy, they're going to be interested in influencing him as the chief in the next year. So there'll be a lot of jockeying position, a dramatic change in the internal dynamics of the court.
Viet Dinh thinks that Roberts will be an engaged and engaging chief who may have influence beyond his role as chief.
I think where Chief Justice Roberts will have a significant role is in his vaunted interpersonal skills in dealing with members of the court whom he knows intimately as an advocate and knows the fault lines of their jurisprudence and also their personalities.
And Lazarus says his old friend will likely mark time before he seeks any major change in either the court's doctrine or its practices.
He's going to have different time horizons than a lot of the rest of them. He's coming in at age 50. He's thinking about the court over a long period of time. A lot of them are thinking about, you know, what can we do right now? I think he's going to be more patient.
Still, we will get some early indicators of where the new chief will be ideologically. Later this week, the court will hear arguments in a case from Oregon, the only state in the country that has legalized doctor-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients. The Bush administration will argue that the state is not free to authorize the lethal use of narcotics under the administration's interpretation of the federal drug law. Then next month, the court will hear argument in a case testing whether Congress exceeded its authority when it required public institutions, in this case state prisons, to make reasonable accommodations for disabled prisoners. Also to be argued next month is a challenge to the so-called Solomon Amendment, which cuts off all federal aid to universities if they don't allow the military to recruit lawyers on campus. The law was passed after many law schools required the military to recruit off-campus because the schools viewed the military's don't ask, don't tell rule as violating the school's anti-discrimination policy. Also this term, there are important cases testing the constitutionality of both federal and state campaign finance laws. And in just a few short weeks, there's an abortion case testing a New Hampshire parental notification law that has no provision for going ahead with an abortion without parental notification when a minor's health is at serious risk. Justice O'Connor has consistently been the deciding vote in declaring that an abortion regulation that doesn't provide an exception to prevent a woman's health is an unconstitutional burden on a woman's right to choose, former Solicitor General Ted Olson.
It will be interesting to see the extent to which the undue burden standard, which is a creation of Justice O'Connor, survives her departure from the court in this very, very contentious area.
Waiting in the wings are other abortion cases, testing the constitutionality of the federal so-called partial birth abortion law, a law that also has no health exception. And there are important national security cases, testing the constitutionality of the tribunals at Guantanamo Bay and the imprisonment without trial of an American citizen arrested on U.S. shores. In short, it will be a fascinating and blockbuster term. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.